From the PA Foundation, I'm James Millward. This is Vital Minds, a podcast connecting the most vital issues in clinical care with the top minds facing them every day. Here at Vital Minds, we have talked about a variety of topics, from addiction to obesity, vaccinations to mood disorders, and everything in between. One area that has a direct impact across all areas of healthcare is nutrition. Now, according to the USDA, fewer than 1 in 6 adults meets the daily intake recommendation for vegetables. However, 90% of Americans eat more than their recommended daily amount of sodium. And added sugars and solid fats contribute to 40% of total daily calories for youths aged 2 to 18 years old. As healthcare providers, we know that good health starts with good nutrition. I'm very excited to welcome today's guest, Ellen Mandel, DMH, MPA, PAC, RDN, and CDE, who is a nutritionist and diabetes educator, as well as a professor at the Johnson & Wales PA program, to today's episode. Ellen, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome, James. I'm very happy to be here to talk about this important topic.
Now, Ellen, before we get started, I always like to ask people what kind of inspired them to go into medicine and to get to where they're at. Now, I know you started out as a registered dietitian and then became a PA. Now, in both professions, you're engaging with patients to improve their health, and you've had a large focus on nutrition. Now, let's start with your time as a registered dietitian. What inspired you to pursue that path?
So I went to college at a time when we were required to take a lot of liberal arts education. And interestingly, I actually entered college as a French major. And so I was deep taking advanced grammar and literature and said, oh, this is really going very well. And then I was required to take a science course. And I said, well, you know, science, not my thing. I'll study French. So I took an intro to nutrition course. And by the third class of this course, I realized there was something going on with this nutrition topic. And I began to realize that I was falling for it. And that when I was studying nutrition in this class, it also became clear to me that people's cultures and language and their choices of food all actually were part of nutrition. And so I began to see that, well, I don't know, maybe being a French major isn't going to get me a job, but being a dietitian may actually put food on my table. I decided to switch majors, and luckily I did it early enough that I graduated in 4 years, and that was important. And so my love of nutrition actually was a segue from my love of culture and language.
I think that's an interesting path you took. A lot of people, I think, have a similar experience where they start out in one direction and find something else that really draws them. You make a good point, though, about the culture of food. Every culture eats differently. I imagine in France, they eat quite differently than we do. And most people don't think of French food as quite healthy. But again, their eating habits are quite different from ours.
Well, you know, James, it's a very important observation. You've probably heard of the French paradox. It was a popular media blitz, I would say, in the last few years. And I've done some reading about that because, indeed, the French do eat cheeses and, you know, a fair bit of bread. However, the difference in the culture is they tend to drink a little bit of wine with meals. And also, they are much more active than folks are in the United States. However, there is one interesting point in reviewing things. The way that deaths are recorded on death certificates in France are actually different than in the United States. And so the reporting of death from cardiovascular disease may actually represent itself very differently than here. So I think, in a way, the French paradox could actually be related to reporting methods. So the jury's still out on that a little bit for me.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, you are clearly very passionate about nutrition with your history as a dietitian, and yet you moved on and became a PA. Now, tell me more about that transition.
Well, becoming a dietitian and working as a dietitian was fantastic. It's a great career. I worked in a teaching hospital, luckily, which allowed me to be involved in morning rounds and surgical and medical cases. So it was really a great first area of study. However, I began to notice patients' nutritional needs, whether they were pre or post-op and needed additional protein and calories, or whether they were anemic, they had lipid disorders, and back then they didn't even look at LDL, it was more total cholesterol. I began to notice that, at least it seemed to me, that the physicians were really not willing to pay too much attention to this. And I did become frustrated because I needed to constantly ask doctors, would you mind ordering this lab, and have to explain why I wanted it? So this kind of drove me to consider either medical school or to venture into this new world called the career of physician assistant. And in the state of New Jersey, PAs were not yet licensed. And so it was a bit of a leap of faith, but it was a really good leap of faith. So I'm glad I've done it. And I've been a PA now for over 20 years.
That is great. Now let's dive a little bit deeper into nutrition. I recently read a statistic that nearly half of Americans suffer from preventable and nutrition-related chronic diseases. The CDC has reported that the prevalence of obesity in the United States is nearly 40% in 2016. And we know as providers, the negative sequel of this poor nutrition can lead to things like hypertension, hyperlipidemia, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, strokes, and even certain types of cancers. With nearly half of Americans suffering from this, it's obviously a very high number speaking to this alarming trend. How do you react to that?
Well, I have been reacting to this for a very long time. I believe that my initial interest in training as a registered dietitian and then also as a certified diabetes educator put me on the front line of working with patients and continuing to delve into the research of metabolic syndrome and other issues that were producing things like hypertension, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and dyslipidemia. So this is an area of interest that's been ongoing for me. The nutrition and endocrine literature was ahead of the curve, as one would expect, in terms of reporting these types of epidemics. In fact, it was over 20 years ago when an Australian physician referred to metabolic syndrome, or syndrome X, it actually has gone by many names over the past years, was actually an epidemic. And he pointed out quite correctly that it had become global. And when we began to look at the maps of what was going on in first, second, third world countries, we began to see that the incidence of overweight and obesity directly correlated with these other types of comorbid conditions. So from an epidemiological perspective, this is not a new thing. I am pleased, I would say, that the U.S. government has and other organizations are really hammering down on this issue and beginning to be much more direct about or even prescriptive about what needs to be done. So if we don't catch it at this point, we will be continuing to expend tremendous resources, both financial and psychosocial, in terms of managing this. It's deeply concerning. And I hope that we can mention a little bit about how we need to do prevention, not just treatment.
No, I totally agree with you on the prevention side of things. Now, for me, working in the Midwest in cardiovascular surgery, the Midwest is one of the areas with the highest obesity rates. The Midwest and southern states have been hit the hardest by this. Patients, when they come to us, have that late-stage heart disease and things that could have been prevented so many years before with healthy habits that they were not equipped with the knowledge or the ability to actually perform. Now, earlier I mentioned that fewer than one in six adults is eating enough vegetables, but a whopping 90% of individuals are eating too much sodium. Does that surprise you?
It does not surprise me. The trend toward fast food as well as convenience foods has been rising steadily. And if the public would take a serious look at reading food labels, which I think is actually an important area of education that PAs can play a large role, they would see that many of these foods contain very high numbers of milligrams of sodium for rather small or even just average portion sizes. And many Americans do, unfortunately, eat portion sizes that are larger than what used to be the typical portion size, let's say of the 60s and 70s. So they're consuming a lot of sodium along with a lot of fat. Trans fats have been removed from the food supply right now, but that's for foods that are made here. The imported foods still contain trans fats. We're seeing this change in eating habits, partially because people work longer hours or their desire to cook. And there have even been cookbooks and recipes that come out that's called slow cooking. When I grew up, slow cooking is what my mother did every night, right? I mean, you know, she would peel potatoes and boil them. And I guess that's considered slow because there was no microwave. So we're in a very different place in terms of what constitutes healthy food and normal or typical eating behaviors.
I agree with you. I think the timing of how long it takes to make food is something that many patients are frustrated with as well. I think it's one of the contributing factors that adds to the fast food issue that we have here in America, where it's quick, it's easy, and it is unhealthy. Now, what other factors have you found that lead Americans to having these poor diets?
Well, I would have to say that it isn't only diet. I think it's also the lack of activity. And if you notice, I use the word activity, not exercise, because exercise has a specific connotation. Sedentary behaviors also play a role. However, when it comes to food, it's been my observation that there's been an influx of what I call the magic bullet, or the quick approach to doing all kinds of things related to nutrition. For example, the use of shakes or smoothies, which can often have a very large amount of calories, but they're so quick and they're so tasty, and they have this connotation of being healthy. Well, they have a good amount of vitamin C and potentially vitamin A. They have plenty of carbs. They provide lots of free water. However, they're not exactly meeting the general overall needs of what a person would require for, let's say, one or two meals, which is what the calories usually add up to. So I think there's a certain amount of magical thinking. There are also quick weight loss diets that people do participate in. Some of them, like meal replacers, may actually be fine for one meal a day. There's a number of different products on the market that offer balanced nutrition, and substituting one meal a day with something like that might be reasonable. However, the interest in this magical approach to weight loss and that certain foods have a particular power that other foods do not is actually leading us astray from, I think, what Mother Nature really would like us to do, which is to have protein, carbohydrate, fats at just about every meal, and eat a variety of foods, eat a lot of fresh, unprocessed foods. There's also a stigma associated with canned vegetables. However, we have to be careful with that because in some communities, there is limited freezer space and also a limited amount of produce. So if a patient would like to or needs to use canned products, that's also okay. If they can buy canned products that are packaged and say low sodium, that's also good. If I were them, I would still compare what does low sodium mean compared to the regular canned product, because it may not be that different, but the low sodium may be more expensive. They can then also, if they need to buy the canned product, they can rinse it in water and reduce the amount of sodium. And they still need to consider that as an option because it might be more nutritious than some of the other things that they would be eating.
I agree. And I think you mentioned a great point there as to things that are available in your neighborhood. Because according to the HHS, there are 23 million Americans currently living in food deserts. And I know I've spoke with patients and they talk about the high cost of produce and fresh meat and eating healthy as a burden to their family, especially with those that are in the lower socioeconomic status. Now, how do you treat or react to patients in such situations?
Well, first of all, I validate their observation because food deserts are authentic. They challenge, as you indicate, James, a very high number of people. And it can be frustrating for folks who are being told you need to eat this or that, or they read it on a reliable blog or a reliable website, and they really just can't get to it. I'd like to mention a brief anecdote. It was actually an assignment when I was doing my dietetic internship. I did this training in an inner city. It was actually in Newark, New Jersey. And the pediatric dietitian gave us an assignment, and she said, go to a kind of upscale suburban grocery store, and I want you to look at all the types of baby foods that are available on the counter, and I want you to select 10 or 20 and jot down the prices. And then I want you to go to an inner city grocery store and see what is the variety of baby foods that are available in that store and jot down the prices. Well, I can tell you this was a very early rude awakening for me, because it was obvious that the variety of healthier baby foods was much lower or smaller in the inner city, and that the prices were higher. And so right off the bat, I said, you know, this is starting when babies are born. I mean, this is going to progress. So coming back to the idea of food deserts for adults, I believe that we need to start retraining or re-exposing people to the idea of how to cook foods that really are available where they live, but also not to walk past the types of fruits and vegetables that are found in your neighborhood, and to select carbohydrates. Most stores would have oatmeal. Most stores would have carrots. I mean, these are not considered, you know, exotic or hard to find foods, but yet people may not really know how to actually peel and slice a carrot and just cook it, you know, for 5 minutes until it's a little crunchy and get plenty of nutrition for a very cheap price. And they don't know necessarily how simple it is, really, to prepare oatmeal for breakfast, whether they cook it in a pan or they put it in the microwave with either milk or water and throw in some raisins, which are also available in just about every store you go to. So I think that people are really, they have lost the capacity to think about cooking and eating in a way that is just simple. So this is where we have to start with children and the school districts, and also to orient parents and adults that it needs to be a family event. Cooking and eating are family events. And let me teach my child that carrots taste good without butter and cinnamon and sugar on top, something like that.
I think those are some great examples. And as providers, we have that unique opportunity to help empower our patients to utilize everything at their disposal to improve their health and their eating habits. Now, thinking about your own patients, in what ways are you seeing that poor eating habits are affecting their overall health?
Well, James, I've had the fortune of working in family practice, urgent care, and also in directly in endocrine. And one may say, oh, endocrine, that means you saw patients with diabetes and thyroid disease and osteoporosis. And the answer is, well, yes, of course, that's pretty much, if you add in thyroid, that's pretty much the bread and butter of endocrine practices. However, I think that PAs who do not work in endocrine are seeing all the same disorders. And I believe that family practitioners, whether they be nurse practitioners, PAs, DOs, or MDs, they are referred to as the gatekeepers. And so they are going to see these types of disorders right from the gate. You know, someone's going to walk in with fatigue, poor wound healing, and you're going to say, oh, look at that. The A1C is elevated and you qualify for prediabetes. This is way before they ever get to an endocrine office. And possibly another anecdote might be nice here. When I first started working in family practice right out of PA school, I recall asking a woman who came in for a routine female exam. And when we were done, I casually said to her, do you think you're getting enough calcium? And she just looked at me with an expression of disbelief. And she said, well, why are you asking me that? Is there something wrong? Do I have a low calcium in my blood? And I said, no, your calcium level is fine. I'm worried about your bones 20 years from now. And she looked at me and she said, you're the first healthcare provider who has ever posed this type of question to me. And I said, well, I'm on a campaign to make questions like this become routine. I'm glad that you are appreciating it. And that was, again, another wake-up call for me. It's a little hard for me, honestly, to separate out my skill set as a dietitian and a CDE from being a PA. But because I actually see them as a blended product, especially what's now essential to providing medical care to our patients, I am on a campaign, and that's part of the reason why I'm so thrilled to be talking about this. And in terms of my patients, I talk to them about how they're eating right from the first 5 minutes of basically meeting them. And I might give them the request to fill out a food record, or I may fill it out with them. And every time I would see them in a follow-up visit, I'd say, hey, let's take a look at how you're doing. Do you recall last time you said you were going to try not to eat after 8 o'clock at night, or you were going to try and eat a healthier breakfast? How is that going for you? I think that when you bring it up, just like how you're doing with stopping smoking, I've used eating healthier as the same paradigm as suggesting to patients that they cut back or reduce or stop smoking. To me, they are all in the same place.
I agree. And I think it's important what you mentioned, that it's how we bring it up. We have to initiate the conversation with our patients. I know with most of my patients, unfortunately, have the trifecta for heart disease of diabetes, hypertension, and hyperlipidemia. And after surgery, we're often talking about their nutrition and how are they going to recover effectively, and talking about protein intake and reminding patients at that follow-up. And it's amazing to see them respond to that and say, I've been doing this and I'm doing what I can with this and this and this, and seeing them change their habits because a conversation was started previously before they left the hospital. Now, what other factors are you seeing that are really contributing to poor diet and poor eating habits in our patients? Because we know it's not just food availability or selection that is causing so much of the problem around us.
Well, James, I completely agree with that, because if it was just food, we probably wouldn't be in this predicament. I also believe that there's very strong psychosocial components, and being overweight or obese or having diabetes or having other types of morbidities or conditions, patients feel stigmatized. There's been a lot of research, particularly in the area of diabetes, that patients will not even go for diabetes educational programs, which may be completely funded through Medicare, for example, or through their private insurance. And they don't go because they don't want to be in a room admitting that they have problems with their health or problems with their eating or problems in general. So there's a certain stigma that's associated with this. And until we begin to accept people for what they are, and for practitioners such as PAs to say, well, we can continue to dwell on the past and we could talk about all of the failures or what patients may assign as a failure, but I would like to talk about potential. And when I am sitting in this exam room with you and I am looking at you as a person, all I see is someone who has opportunity. It's the window of opportunity. So why don't we crack the window and see the small or larger ways that we can impact this problem so that you can have many, many years of a healthy quality of life, and also that you could set up the next generation of people in your family to not have the same issues that you have had. Because what a great feeling to know that maybe you have a child who is starting to creep up on the growth curve and you're a little worried about them. What can you do so that your legacy is a really positive, healthy legacy for your family? And James, I have to tell you, the kinds of expressions that I see on people's faces, it's almost as though their faith is restored, that they say, wow, you know, I never thought about how I'm a role model for my kids. I've always worried about oh, you know, I have this illness and what am I going to do with it? And woe is me. But you've instilled in me the feeling that I actually have potential to do something really, really good. Make it small steps. Small steps really work, and all the steps add up to a mile. So that's kind of I think that's really the perspective and the approach that I use.
I like that approach, and I like that you focus on it beginning in the home. Good eating habits begin so young and continue on if they are instilled in our youth. Now, we know there are obviously these social determinants that impact depression, mental health. They kind of all go together. You see a lot of overeating or eating disorders, and removing that stigma, I think, is so important as providers to have a compassionate conversation and show empathy to our patients.
I agree. Social determinants of health is really a more relatively new buzzword. And I think at times it's still being defined. However, just the fact that it's on the table, as they say, and I know that the AAPA has a deep investment in the area of mental health, and this is coming through in a variety of ways, through publications and CME. So we're in the right place. We're stepping through the door. And I believe that on the other side of this door are some very positive potential outcomes.
Now, I have another question. As a teacher, how are you training your PAs to talk to their patients about nutrition for themselves and for their children? Because we know that talking about nutrition with our patients, it can be difficult. It takes time. And patients don't want to feel judged by their eating habits or their food choices. So how are you teaching students to effectively have this conversation?
The importance of being able to include health and nutrition and activity as a part of our review of systems, I think that PA students and PA educators are really quite expert at teaching PA students how to ask open-ended questions, how not to lead the patient, how to cover sensitive areas such as a sexual history. I think that we need to apply the same power and approach to teaching our students to ask questions about what is sensitive to them, such as their body image and how they feel about food, and do they feel that they're being bullied by people or their children are being bullied in school. So I see a lot of hope in this area. Specifically, one of the things I do is I have my students keep a food record. I have them read over and I give them a handout that's called myplate.gov. And I have them keep a food record for 24 hours, write everything down. And then I have them team up with a partner, a PA partner, you know, a student partner, and have them actually do a role play of how would you explain to the patient that you see maybe some areas of concern about how they're eating. How would you tell them the good things that they're doing? Wow, you know, I see that you don't eat, you know, a lot of sweet foods, or you drink diet soda, or you drink seltzer with a little bit of lemon. What makes you do that? Why aren't you drinking a regular sugared beverage? And see what the person says. So I actually am giving them real life training on how to have a diet recall analyzed in a setting that is very similar to what they might be doing when they graduate.
I think that's great. And having students take that food journal, that food diary, gives them that experience of what we're going to request of our patients. Now, when you are with patients, do you have a method or a process for how you open this conversation with your patients that you know are struggling with nutrition issues?
Yes, I do, James. And I usually ask the patient, are you concerned at all about your nutritional intake? Or are you concerned about the way you feel? And is it possibly related to your activity level or even the body weight? Is this something that crosses your mind? And then I don't say another word. I sit quietly, relaxed. I give them the authentic impression that I really want to hear what they are going to say next. And I don't cut them off. And people will often sense right away that you are in their court. You want to know who they are. You want to know what they're thinking and feeling, and that you are patient. And it doesn't take long for people to sense that, and then they begin to open up. And boy, does it work. I have seen it.
I think that's a great method, focusing on, you know, the empathy and empowering the patient to express themselves in a very free manner has such a powerful impact.
Thank you, James. I have fine-tuned this over many years, and I do feel very, very happy that I can bring this to my students, my patients, and even my colleagues. They know that I talk up the subject whenever the opportunity arises.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, no matter your medical specialty, be it family practice or across the board in my realm of CV surgery, in mental health, nutrition always seems to come into play. Now, for those of us who don't have an extensive background in nutrition or the training you do as a prior registered dietitian, what resources are there out there that you'd recommend clinicians go look to or use to improve their nutrition conversations with patients?
First of all, I would say the American Academy of Physician Assistants has truly stepped up. Their Learning Central area online has information related to obesity and many other nutrition topics. And we're actually working on some other material together that will be very helpful. The American Diabetes Association publishes an annual report, which now they update in real time, that has the guidelines for dealing with people who have pre-diabetes, gestational diabetes, and of course, type 1, type 2, and all the other types of diabetes. That's published in Diabetes Care. However, it is also available free online. Another area that people can look to is the American Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And they have a website called Eat Right, all one word, eatright.org. And there's a lot of really practical information that PAs can go to review things and get some really good research information. Of course, there's the Dietary Guidelines for America, which can be found at the hhs.org website. There's another website called health.gov. And of course, I referenced this a little earlier about myplate.gov. If PAs go to Choose My Plate, they will find a tremendous amount of practical information that can be used by patients and for patients. And that's just the tip of the iceberg, James.
I agree. I think there are so many great resources out there. And the thing that I love about this is a lot of this data is new. It is current and it is very useful. Now, Ellen, this has been very helpful. And if there's one thing you would hope our listeners take away from this, what would it be?
I knew you were going to ask that question, James. Let's see. Actually, I have an answer. Moderation. I think that people are very hard on themselves. And if they take the view that making moderate, small steps that will lead to an important and improved outcome, it means that they feel better about themselves. They can often feel good about themselves. And they're moving in the right direction. And also the whole adage of one step forward, two steps back, we got to be careful with that. As long as we are making baby steps in the right direction, we are not taking steps backward. So I say go for the big M, which is moderation.
I like that. Now, because nutrition is such an important topic for PAs and all medical providers to understand and have the resources to talk about with our patients. Ellen, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today.
It's been a pleasure, James. Thank you, too.
Now, for all our listeners, we'd like to encourage you to visit the PA Foundation website at pa-foundation.org for additional resources. While you're there, be sure to catch up on all of our Vital Minds episodes. Support for this episode of Vital Minds is provided by Abbott Nutrition. Until next time, everyone, I'm James Millward, and this is Vital Minds.